Oh, you look.
I'll bet that 5 copper fine that she's not interested. And I'll bet you I'll spear her by midnight. You arrogant son of a bitch, said Will with a smile. I'm going to enjoy watching you cut down to size. The two soldiers angled through the crowd, coming alongside the woman as she stood by the dried fruit stall. Good morning, miss, said Will. That's a fine bird. The woman offered a fleeting smile. She hunts well, was all she said. Then she turned away. Are you from the Highlands? Asked Ralph. The woman swung back. I am. Why'd you ask? My friend did a little bit with me. I said you were mountain bred. He insisted you were a lowlander. I told him you could always tell a Highland woman. Tell her what? Countered the woman, turning her pale gaze on the soldier. No, I mean, recognize one. It's in the walk. Tell me, are you, staying on in Citadel tonight? There are some fine places to dine, and I'd be honored to escort you. No, I'm not staying on. Good day to you. She walked on, but Ralph hurried alongside, taking hold of her arm. This made the hawk bait once more. You don't know what you're missing, sweet thing. It's never wise to turn down a good opportunity. Oh, I never do that, said the woman. Goodbye. She strode off, leaving Ralph red-faced. Ah, said Will. The sound of 5 fresh copper coins jingling in my palm, I can almost hear it. Ralph swore. Who does the bitch think she is? I told you, she's a Highlander. As far as she's concerned, you are an occupying enemy soldier, and if she doesn't hate you, which she probably does, she despises you. Now let's move on, and you can figure out how to pay me. How'd she get a hawk? Said Ralph. I mean, a woman with a hawk. It's not proper. Maybe she stole it. You can put that thought from your mind now, son, said Will sternly. Just because a woman doesn't want to sleep with you, it doesn't mean you can just lock her up. I'll not have that kind of wrongdoing in my cells. Put it from your mind and concentrate on the crowd. It'll be more than a 5 copper fine if there's a purse cut while we're on duty. More like 5 lashes. Yes, said Ralph. Plenty more sheep in the field anyway. He laughed suddenly. Did you hear that Grian picked up a dose of the clap from the whorehouse in North Street? His dick is covered in weeping sores. He's in a hell of a state. They put bloody leeches on it. Can you imagine that? Must be pretty small leeches, eh? Serves him right, said Will. He stopped outside the apothecary shop and stepped inside. What are we looking for? Asked Ralph. My youngest has a whooping cough. Betsy asked me to pick up some herb syrup. Always ailing, that boy, ever since the fever, said Ralph. You figure him to die? Will sighed. We lost 2 already, Ralph. One in the plague back in Angosta, and the second when I was campaigning in Cushier. Yellow fever struck him down. I don't know whether the boy will survive or not, but he's a fighter like his dad, so he's got an even chance. You were lucky with Betsy, said Ralph, as Will waited for the apothecary to fill a small blue bottle with syrup. She's a good woman, cooks up a fine stew, and your place is always so clean. I bet you could eat off the floor and not pick up a scrap of dust. Good woman. The best, agreed Will. I think when summer comes I'll try to relocate down south. Her folks is back there and she misses them. Might do that. There's a rumour we'll be campaigning in spring. You heard it. There's always rumours, son. I don't worry about them. One of the reasons I came here was for the quiet. Betsy was always worried I'd be killed in a battle. There ain't no battles here. So who are we going to campaign against?
The captain was saying that the Highland clans were getting ready for war, attacking merchants and travellers.
Will shook his head. It's not true. There was 1 attack, but the foresters caught the men and killed them. They weren't Highlanders. No, I'm looking forward to summer, son. I'll take the family south.
The apothecary handed over the bottle, and Will gave him 2 copper coins. Outside, Ralph tapped him on the arm. How come you pay?
I don't. Bastard town is going to afford to look after us. After all, we look after them. I always pay my way, said Will. It's an old habit.
Grain, the smith, delivered the Baron's grey stallions and left the citadel. It had been no surprise when the Baron fell to pay for the work, and Grain had been expecting nothing more. He wandered through the town and considered buying a meal at the Blue Duck Tavern. Roast pork with crackling was a speciality there. Grain tapped his ample stomach. You're getting old and fat, he told himself. There was a time when he'd been considered one of the handsomest men in Kilfallon, and he had grown used to the eyes of women lingering on him as he passed. They didn't linger much now. His hair had long since departed his skull and sprouted unattractively from his shoulders and back. He'd lost 3 front teeth and had his lips crushed at Colden Moor, the teeth smashed from his head by an iron club wielded by an outland soldier. God, that hurt, he remembered. It was a kind of double pain. As he fell, he knew his good looks were gone forever. Now he sported the bushiest white beard with a long, drooping moustache to cover the mouth. He reluctantly passed the Blue Duck and continued along Market Street, catching sight of Sigani talking to 2 soldiers. The first was a tall man, middle-aged, with the look of the warrior about him. The second was smaller. This one took hold of Sigani's arm, but she spoke to him and moved away. Graham saw the man's face turn crimson. The smith chuckled and made his way to where Sigani was standing before a knick-knack stall. She was examining a brass tail-bell. "Good day to you," said Graham. Sigani gave him a friendly smile, but he saw her cast her eyes back towards where the 2 soldiers were standing.
"I'm thinking of buying Abby a bell," she said. "All the other hawks here have them."
"For what purpose?" asked the smith, apart from the fact that all the others have them.
Sigani thought about it for a moment, then grinned.
"I don't know, Graham," she admitted, "but they are pretty, don't you think?"
Graham took the bell from her fingers and looked at it closely.
"They're well made," he said, "and they'd be silent in flight. Falconers use them to locate their birds. You can hear them when they land in a tree. Do you have trouble with Abby? Do you lose her?"
"Never."
"Then you don't need a bell."
"What brings you to Citadel?"
"There's a hawking tourney, with a money prize of 2 gold guineas. I think Abby could win it."
Graham scratched at his thick white beard.
"Maybe. It will depend on how they structure the contest. If obedience is marked highly, you would have a good chance, but speed? The goshawk is lighter and faster than Abby."
"You surprise me, Graham. I didn't know you understood falconry."
"Had a goss myself once. Beautiful creature, but willful. Lost her in the year before Colden. I take it you're trying to get Abby used to crowds before the tourney."
"Yes,"
answered Sigani, stroking Abby's sleek head.
"They don't seem to bother her. She's baited a few times, but I think she'll perform well. I'll bring her again tomorrow."
"Is there an entrance fee to this tournament?"
"Yes, 1 silver penny. I paid it this morning."
Sigani's expression changed.
"The cleric had to get permission from the captain of the tourney to allow me to enter. He wasn't sure if women were permitted to take part."
Graham chuckled.
"Well, it is unusual, girl. They don't understand that Highland women are,
shall we say,
different."
"From what?" she countered.
"From their own timid females," said Graham. "Their women have no rights. When they marry, all their fortunes become the property of their husbands. They can be beaten, humiliated, and cast aside, with no recourse to the law."
"That is awful. Why do the women stand for it?"
Graham shrugged.
"Habit? God only knows. The fathers choose their husbands, the husbands dominate their lives. It's a world ruled by men. So, the captain of the tourney allowed your entry. He must be an enlightened man."
"He was fascinated by Abby. I could tell. He asked me where I got her and how many kills she had. That sort of thing. He said the Baron would be interested in her."
Graham said nothing for a moment. Then,
"I'm not sure I like the sound of that, Sigani."
"Why?"
"You don't come to the Citadel much, do you?" "No, of course you don't. You sell your skins to the tanner and the furrier and you buy your supplies, what, 3 times a year?"
4 times? What does that matter?
The Baron is a keen falconer. He will certainly be interested in Abby. He may want her for his own.
Well, he can't have her, she said.
Graham smiled, but there was no humour in the expression. The Baron will have anything he desires. He is the Lord here. My advice is to forget the Tony and take Abby back into the mountains.
I paid my silver penny.
Graham reached into his pouch and produced a coin. I'll pay that, aye, and gladly.
I don't want your money, Graham, though I thank you for the offer. You think he would steal her from me?
Graham nodded.
But how could he do this? By what right?
Conquest, you are a clan woman. You have no right save those he allows. Sigourney's face darkened.
By God, that is wrong!
I don't doubt that by God it is wrong, but it is not God who makes the laws here. It is the Baron. I have some business here, but I will be ready to leave by dusk. My wagon is by the north wall, behind the armourer's shop. I'd be pleased to have the company, if you'd like a ride back to Kilfallan.
Yes, I would, said Sigourney. I'll meet you there at dusk.
Graham's words both irritated and upset Sigourney. She had wanted to compete, to show Abby's skills to a wider audience, to revel in their approbation. And she wanted to show that a woman could train a hawk as well as any man. Yet Graham was no fool. If he said she was in danger of losing Abby, then she had to listen and act accordingly. It was unfair, but then life was unfair. If not, then she would have loved Bernd, and he would still be alive. Sigourney strolled through the crowds and on to Falcon Field, passing the rows of hutches containing the hares to be used in the falcon displays, snared over the past few days. The little beasts would be freed individually to dart and run across the field, seeking escape from the silent killers sent to dispatch them. Abby's golden eyes focused on the cowering creatures.
"Not for you, pretty one," said Sigourney. "Not this time. No applause for my beautiful Abby."
The cleric was still sitting at his desk on the outer edge of the field, and several falconers were waiting to sign their names, or make their marks, on the broad ledger. A cadger had been set close by, hooded falcons sitting on the many perches. All were goshawks. Abby bridled and baited as she saw them, her wings flaring out.
"Hush, no," whispered Sigourney. "Best behaviour from you, sweet one."
Behind the cleric, she saw the two soldiers who had spoken to her earlier. The big one was no problem, but the shorter man had mean eyes. Beyond them stood the captain of the tourney. She could not remember his name, save that it began with red, which matched his beard and his complexion. Taking her place behind the men, she waited her turn. One of the falconers looked closely at Abby.
"Fine creature,"
he said.
"Never thought to see another. Cushier bird, ain't she?"
"Yes."
"Good killers. Not as fast as my own bird, but she'll come to call a damn sight faster."
Reaching out, he stroked Abby's chest with a broad forefinger. To Sigourney's annoyance, Abby allowed this treatment, even seemed to enjoy it.
"Next!" called the cleric.
He was ginger-haired, and Sigourney remembered him riding with an escort through Kilfallan, taking the census. What was his name? Andred. No, Andolf. The falcon assigned his name, paid his silver, and moved away to the cadger to collect his bird. Sigourney stepped forward and Andolf glanced up.
"Oh, 'tis you. You've already signed." "And now I wish to unsign. I cannot take part after all."
"I see," said Andolf, laying down his quill.
"I am afraid there are no allowances made for withdrawals. I take it you are seeking your money back."
"Yes. Why pay for something I cannot do?"
"Why, indeed, however, the rules are quite specific. If a falcon becomes ill or the falconer fails to appear, then his entry fee is forfeit. You see, it is the entry fee that creates the ultimate prize."
"I only signed an hour ago," she said, smiling sweetly. "Can you not make an exception for a poor mountain girl?"
Andolf blushed.
Well, as you say, it was only an hour since.
Reaching into the box at his left hand,
He removed a silver penny and handed it to her. Abby baited once more, and the little man dropped the coin in Sigani's palm and snatched his hand away.
"I really don't like them," he confided. "I prefer the hares."
"Hares were created for sport," said Sigani.
Four riders came galloping across the field, their horses' hooves drumming on the hard-packed clay. Abby fluffed up her feathers, but Sigani held tightly to the flying jesses. The lead horseman, a man dressed all in black, dismounted from the grey stallion, tossing the reins to a second horseman. Sigani stood silently, for all the men were now waiting, stiff-backed. Even the little cleric had risen from his seat. This, then, she knew must be the Baron. Inwardly, Sigani cursed herself for bothering about the entry fee, for the man was staring intently at Abby. He was a tall man with sleek black hair drawn back tightly over his brow and tied in a short ponytail at the nape of his neck. He sported a thin, trident beard that gleamed as if oiled, and his eyes were large and wood-ash grey, hooded and bulging from their sockets. His lips were thin. The mouth cruel, thought Sigani.
"Where did you get the bird?"
he asked, the voice so low that it was a moment before Sigani realized he had spoken.
"A gift from a friend," she answered him.
The other riders dismounted and gathered in close. Sigani felt hemmed in, but she stood her ground.
"In return for some sexual favour, I don't doubt," said the Baron, his tone bored. "Ah, well, I expect you are here to sell the creature. I'll give you 10 guineas for it, assuming you haven't ruined it."
"She is not ruined, my lord, and she is not for sale," said Sigani. "I trained her myself, and I was planning to enter the tourney with her."
The Baron appeared not to notice she had spoken. Turning to the man behind him, he called out,
10 guineas, if you please, little frick. I'll reimburse you later, and remind me to speak to the black man next time he visits the town."
"Yes, my lord," said the blonde rider, fishing in his purse for coins. Sigani stepped back.
"She is not for sale," she said,
her voice louder than she intended. This time the Baron turned and, for the first time, looked into her eyes.
"You are a Highlander, aren't you?"
he announced.
"I am. There are no noble houses in the Highlands, merely a motley group of inbred savages scraping a living from the mountainsides. The law is simple, woman. A yeoman may raise a goshawk. That is the only bird of prey allowed to those not of noble blood. The bird you hold is not a goshawk, therefore you cannot own the bird. Am I speaking too fast for you? Now take the money and hand the bird to my falconer."
Sigani knew that she should obey. It mattered not that it was unfair. Graham was right. The Baron was the law, and to deny him would be futile. Yet something flickered deep within her, like the birth of a fire.
"I am of the blood of Gandarin the King," she said, "and the hawk is mine, mine to keep, mine to free."
So saying, her arm swept up, and she released the jesses. Surprised by the sudden movement, Abby spread her wings and sailed into the air. Not even a glimmer of anger showed on the Baron's face. For several heartbeats no one moved, and all watched the hawk gliding up on the thermals. Then, without speed, almost casually, the Baron's black-gloved fist cracked against the side of Sigani's face. Half-stunned, she staggered back. The Baron moved in. Sigani lashed out with her foot, aiming for his groin. But her aim was out, and she kicked him in the thigh.
"Hold her," said the Baron.
She found her arms pinned and recognized the soldiers who had first spoken to her in the market square. The Baron hit her in the stomach, and she doubled forward. His voice echoed through her pain. It was not a raised voice, nor did it contain a hint of emotion.
"Stupid woman," he said. "Now you have forfeit your right to the 10 guineas. Any more stupidity, and you will face the lash. You understand me?" "Call the bird."
Sigourney looked up into the hooded eyes. Her mouth tasted of blood.
"Call him yourself," she said,
then spat full in his face. Blood and saliva dripped to his cheek. Taking a black handkerchief from the pocket of his tunic, he slowly wiped the offending drops from his face.
"You see,"
he said to the gathered men, "with what we are dealing. A people who have no understanding of law or good manners. They are barbarians without culture, without breeding." His hand lashed out in a backward strike that cannoned his knuckles against Sigourney's right cheek.
"Call the bird," he ordered, "and if you spit at me again, I will have your tongue cut out."
Sigourney remained silent. The Baron turned to his falconer, a short, wide-shouldered lowlander.
"Can you call it in?" he asked.
"I'll do my best, my lord,"
he answered, moving out onto the open ground with hawking glove aloft. He gave a long, thin whistle. High above, Abby banked and folded her wings into a stoop to dive like an arrow. Some 60 feet from the ground, her wings spread again and she levelled out.
"She's coming in, sir," shouted the falconer.
The Baron turned back to Sigourney.
10 lashes for you, I think, and a night in the cells. Perhaps you will learn from the experience, though I doubt it. You Highlanders never were given to learning from your mistakes. It is what makes you what you are.
Casually, he struck her again, left and right, his arm rising and falling with a sickening lack of speed. Sigourney tried to roll her head with the blows, but the soldiers were holding hard to her arms. And then it happened. No one watching quite understood why. Some blamed confusion in the mind of the hawk. Others maintained the woman was a witch, the hawk, her familiar. But Abby swept down, past the falconer's outstretched glove, and straight towards Sigourney, talons extended for the landing. At that moment, the Baron's fist came up to strike the woman again.
"The hawk, my lord!"
shouted the falconer. The Baron turned, arm still raised. Abby's razor-sharp talons tore into his face, hooking into the left eyebrow, raking down through the socket and tearing out his eye. He screamed as he fell back, the hawk still clinging to his face, her talons embedded in his left cheek. Abby's wings thrashed madly as she tried to free herself. The Baron's hands came up, grabbing the wings and ripping the bird clear. Blood gushed from the face wound. Staggering now, he threw the bird to the ground, and Sigourney watched in horror as one of the riders drew a sword and hacked through Abby's neck. The wings fluttered against the clay. Men gathered round the Baron, who had fallen to his knees, pressing the palm of his black glove against the now empty eye socket. The 3 riders who had arrived with him half carried him from the field. The captain of the tourney moved in front of Sigourney.
"You'll suffer for that, bitch," he told her. "The Baron will have your eyes put out with hot coals, your hands and feet hacked off, and then you'll be hung outside the walls in an open cage for the crows to feast on you. But first, you'll answer to me."
Sigourney said nothing as she was dragged away by the soldiers. A crowd had gathered on the edge of the field, but she did not look at them. Holding her head high, she stared impassively at the keep ahead and the double doors of the outer wall. Abby was dead. Had she given her to the Baron, she would still be alive. She saw again the fluttering wings and the iron sword cleaving down. Tears fell to her cheeks, the salt burning the cut under her eye. The men marched her through the citadel entrance, and then turned left, cutting across the courtyard to a narrow door, and a staircase leading down into the dark. Sigourney pulled back as the men tried to force her through. The soldier whose advances she had spurned struck her over the ear with his elbow.
"Get down there," he hissed.
She was propelled forward. The stairwell was dark, the stairs slippery. The soldier twisted her arm behind her back, the other man releasing his hold on her and moving ahead. For a short while, they descended in total darkness. Then, the faint glow of a burning torch lit the bottom of the stairs, and they emerged into a dungeon corridor. Two men were sitting at a table playing dice. Both stood as the captain strode into sight.
"Open a cell," he ordered.
The men hurried to obey. Sigourney was still in a daze as they dragged her into the cell. It was large and grey, one wall wet with damp, and it stank of rat's droppings. There was a small cot in one corner, and there were rusted chains hanging from the walls.
"How do you like this, bitch?"
sneered the red-bearded captain, moving in front of her. Sigourney did not reply. His hand reached out, cupping her breast and squeezing hard. She winced, then brought up her knee, hammering it into his groin. He groaned and fell back. The soldier to her right, the short man, punched her in the side of her head, and she was hurled across the cot.
"Strip her," ordered the captain, "and we'll see how much pleasure the whore can supply."
Through her pain, Sigourney heard the words, and the strength of her panic surged through her. Launching herself from the cot, she dived at the first soldier, but she was still groggy, and he caught her by the hair. Hands grabbed at her body, and she felt her leather leggings being dragged clear. Torchlight glittered from the captain's dagger.
"I'm going to put my mark on you, woman, and I'll hear you beg and scream before this night is over."
Chapter 5 Gwalchmai was sitting on the porch weeping when Asmodea rode up. As the black man climbed from the saddle and approached the old man, he could smell the fiery spirit on Gwalchmai's breath, and he saw the empty jug lying on its side.
"Where is Sigourney?"
he asked. The old man looked up, blinking.
"Suffering," he said. "She is the sword blade going through the fire." "What are you talking about?" "Why do we do it?"
asked Gwal.
"What is it in our natures? When I was young, we raided a lowland village stealing cattle. There was a young woman in a field. She had hidden in some bushes, but we found her. We raped her. It seemed good sport, and no harm done."
He shook his head.
"No harm done? Now that the gift is upon me and I know the truth, I wonder if there will ever be forgiveness. Do you ever wonder that, Asmodea? Do you ever think of the Loabite woman you captured in the high mountains of Kushir? You lie awake at night and ask yourself why she slashed her wrists?"
Asmodea straightened as if struck, his dark eyes narrowing.
"You are the gifted one. Aye, that is my curse, black man. It is only marginally worse than yours."
The sunlight was fading, and Asmodea helped the old man to his feet, guiding him into the cabin, where Lady was stretched out by the dying fire. Asmodea eased Gwalchmai into a chair, then sat opposite the man. Lady rose and put her head in Asmodea's lap, seeking a stroke. The black man idly patted her, rubbing his fingers between her ears, and Lady's tail began to wag.
"I need your help," Asmodea told Gwalchmai. "I need to find the man."
The old man leaned forward and gazed into the dying flames.
"No, you don't," he said, "on both counts. But I will help you, Asmodea. Oh, yes, I will. First, tell me why we are such savages. Tell me that. What do you want from me, gifted one? The answer to questions we all know? We do what we do because we can. We hunt and kill because we can. That which is in our power belongs to us, to be used as we desire, whether it be a round of meat, a wild-born stag, an ancient tree, or a beautiful woman. Now, what is it you want to hear?"
Gwalchmai gave a long sigh and rubbed at weary, bloodshot eyes with a gnarled hand.
"As we sit and speak," he said, "in the warmth of this cabin, there is a woman in a cell, being beaten, brutalized, and raped by five men. She is bleeding. She is hurt. One of the five is a nobleman, but he is filled with a lust for inflicting pain. But the others are all ordinary men. men like you and me, Asma dear. I can feel their thoughts, taste their emotions. By God, I can also sense their arousal, and I would like to kill them. But am I different? Was I different in that field? Were you different with a law-abiding woman? She was part of the spoils of war, said Asmodeus. And no, I do not lie awake at night and think of her. She was used. We are all used. She chose to kill herself, her choice gifted one. But I have no time for these games, nor am I concerned about some whore in a prison cell. Do you know the name of the leader who is coming or not?
Gwalchmai swung round, his eyes bright and glittering.
Yes, I know. I have always known, from the night when the gate was opened, when Taliesin came to me and brought me the child to raise. And will you tell me?
Asked Asmodeus, masking his impatience.
It is not a man. You make no sense, you drunken old fool. What is it then, a tree, a horse? Are you so stupid that you cannot understand what is being said here? Asked Gwalchmai. Where are we, for God's sake? Can you not concentrate that fine mind for a moment?
Asmodeus sat back and took a deep breath.
Humor me,
he said at last.
Perhaps my mind is not as fine as you imagine.
But the old man said nothing, and Asmodeus took a deep breath.
Very well, I will play this game. Where are we, you asked. We are in the Highlands, in the cabin of Sigarni the Huntress, and we have been talking about a woman in a cell.
He sat bolt upright.
Sweet heaven! Sigarni is in the cell? Sigarni is in the cell,
echoed Gwalchmai, tossing a fresh log to the flames.
Why? The Baron desired her hawk. She refused to sell it. In the argument that followed, the hawk tore out the Baron's left eye. Sigarni was dragged away. But she lives. They have not killed her. No, they have not killed her, but they are giving her scars she will carry all her life, and her pain will be visited 1,000 times upon their countrymen. What can I do? Tell me. You can wait here with me. All your questions will be answered, Asma dear. Everyone.
Will Stamper sat in the Blue Duck Tavern, staring into the tankard. It was the 5th jug of ale he had consumed, and it could not deaden the shame he felt. Ralph pushed through the crowd and sat opposite him, a bright smile on his face.
Looks like I don't owe you that 5 coppers any more, eh? Told you I'd spear her by midnight.
Shut up, for God's sake!
What's wrong with you, Will? You were great, weren't it? Nothing like it, and you had your share.
He chuckled.
And the captain, humping like a little bully. Nice to know the nobles get boils on their asses, isn't it?
Will lifted the tankard and half-drained it. The ale was strong, and he felt his head swimming.
I've never done that before, he said. Never will again. I'm not going to wait for the summer. I'm going south tomorrow. I'm finished here. I wish I'd never come.
You've got blood on your hand, said Ralph. Did she bite you?
Will jerked and rubbed the dried blood onto his leather leggings.
No, it's not my blood.
He bit his lip and looked away, but Ralph saw the tears spilling to his cheeks.
What's got into you? Is it the boy? He'll get over the hoop, Will, I'm sure he will. Come on, mate, this isn't like you at all. Here, let me get you another drink.
Ralph stood, but Will reached out and took hold of his arm.
It doesn't bother you, does it? She was screaming. She was cut, bitten, thrashed. It doesn't bother you.
It didn't bother you at the time either. You know, why should it worry me? Worse'll happen to her tomorrow. At least she went out with a good rut, eh? Anyway, the captain told us to. So why not? God's teeth, Will, she's only a whore. Whores were made for sport.
Will released his hold, and Ralph moved back into the crowd. He gazed around him through bleary eyes, listening to the laughter of the revellers. and thought of Betsy, picturing her in that cell. Ralph returned with two tankards.
"Here, get that down, you mate. You'll feel better. There's a dice game back at the barracks at midnight. You fancy a bet?"
"No, I'll get home. Got to get Betsy to pack ready for tomorrow."
"You're not thinking this through, Will. No one will be taking on mercenaries down south. What will you do?"
"I don't care."
Ralph leaned forward.
"You have to care, Will. You have a family to support and a sick son. You can't go dragging them out into the countryside. It's not fair on them. Look, I don't know why this has got you so bad. You stuck a few inches of gristle into a few soft, warm places. Now you want to ruin your life and your family's lives. It don't make no sense. You get home and get a good night's sleep. It'll all look different in the morning."
Will shook his head. "What will look different? I'm 42 years old. I've lived my whole life by an iron set of rules which my dad beat into me. You ever heard me lie, Ralph? You ever seen me steal?"
"No, you're a regular saint, mate. They ought to put up statues to you. But what's the point you're making?"
"I just betrayed everything I've lived for, everything. What we did there was wrong. Worse than that, it was evil."
"Now you're talking daft. What do you mean, evil? She was a slag. And I'll bet she's been jumped before. What picking difference does it make? She's dead anyway come morning. You heard the captain. They're going to put out her eyes and hang her in the old cage. Bloody hell, Will. You think what we done is any worse than that? Come on. I'll walk you home. You look all in."
Ralph stood and helped Will to his feet. The big man staggered, then headed for the door.
"I should have stopped it," mumbled Will. "Not joined in. Oh, God, what will I say to Betsy?"
"Nothing, mate. Nothing at all. You just go home and you sleep."
The relief guard was called Owen Hunter. The man he replaced told him of the sport he had missed. Owen was a lowlander, married to a harridan named Clorry, who made his life a misery. As he sat at the dungeon table in the flickering torchlight, he tried to remember the last time he had enjoyed a woman. It was more than 3 years, if you didn't count the alley whore. He smiled when the guard told him of the afternoon's entertainment, and even managed to say, "That's life," when the man pointed out that it should have been Owen's shift, except that the lowlander had swapped it earlier that day. But now, as he sat alone, he allowed his bitterness to rise. Of all the women to choose, he had married Clorry, sharp-tongued, mean-spirited Clorry. "Life's a bastard and no mistake," thought Owen. Like the other soldiers, he had heard of the incident when the Baron lost his eye. Even now the surgeons were at work in the upper room of the keep, plugging the wound and feeding the Baron expensive opiates. There was no sound in the dungeon corridor, save for the occasional hiss from the torches. Owen stood and stretched his legs, remembering the last words of the man he replaced.
"What an arse on her. I tell you, Owen, she was a jump to remember."
Owen lifted a torch from its bracket and walked past the four empty cells to the locked door. Pulling open the grill, he peered inside. There was no window to the cell, and the torchlight did not pierce the gloom. Slipping the bolt, he opened the door. The woman was lying on the floor, her legs spread open. There was blood on her face and her thighs, and one of her breasts was bleeding. Owen moved closer. She was still unconscious. Despite the blood, he could see that she was beautiful, her hair gleaming silver and red in the torchlight. His eyes scanned her body. Even the hair of her pubic mound was silver, he noticed. She was slim and tall, her breasts firm. Owen saw that one of her nipples was bleeding, a thin trickle of red still running down to her side. Kneeling alongside her, Owen ran his hand up her thigh, his fingers stroking the silver mound, his index finger slipping inside her. He made his decision and rose, planting the torch in a wall bracket. Swiftly, he stripped off his leather leggings and knelt between the open legs, pushing his hands under her thighs to draw her onto him. Why not, he thought, Everyone else has had their pleasure, why not me? Why shouldn't Owen Hunter have a little fun? His last sight was of the woman, suddenly rearing up. His own hands were locked beneath her thighs, but he saw her right hand stab forward, felt the terrible pain as her first two fingers struck his eyes. Then all was pain, and an explosion of light that was unbearable. Sigourney dragged her fingers from the oozing sockets and groaned. Her ribs hurt, but that was as nothing compared with the pain within. She pushed the body of the guard from her, then rolled to her knees. Nausea rose in her throat and she vomited. Her head was pounding, her body begging her to lie down, to rest, to heal. Instead, she forced herself to her feet. The guard began to moan. Dropping to her knees, she pulled his dagger from his belt and plunged it through the nape of his neck. His leg spasmed, one foot striking the narrow cot. Blood filled the man's throat and he began to choke. Dragging the dagger clear, she held the point over the center of his back and threw her weight down upon it. The blade slid between his ribs, skewering the lungs. Now he was still. A pool of urine spread out from beneath him. Sigourney stood again, then sat on the cot looking round the cell, taking in every block and stone, every rat hole. Her leggings had been thrown into a corner. Retrieving them, she dressed. The cord of the waist had been cut. Dragging the guard's belt clear, she pierced a new buckle hole in the leather and strapped it to her waist. Everything hurt. Her lips were swollen, her cheek cut and bruised. There was a knife cut in her right buttock and another on her left thigh. The guard moaned again. Sigourney could not believe the man could still be alive. Taking hold of the jutting knife with both hands, she wrenched it clear of his back, then knelt forward to slice the razor-sharp blade across his throat. Blood gushed to the stone floor. Grabbing him by the shoulders, she rolled him to his back, slashing the sharp blade again and again across his lower body. At last, exhausted, she stopped, her hands drenched in blood. "You've got to get out of here," she told herself. "You've got to find them." She had feigned unconsciousness at the end, even when two of them had stood and urinated over her. She had heard the small man, Ralph, talk about the Blue Duck Tavern. She knew it. It was close to Market Street. Knife in hand, Sigourney walked from the cell and out into the dungeon corridor. Her legs had no strength and she fell to her knees and vomited once more.
"Don't be weak," she scolded herself. "You are Sigourney the Huntress. You are strong."
Rising unsteadily, she managed to reach the stairs and started to climb up into the darkness. Halfway up, she heard footfalls. Pushing herself back against the wall, she waited. Then a man called out from some distance above.
"Hey, Owen, I was on my way home when I thought it would be worth a second tilt at the bitch. You fancy a double, eh?"
From out of the darkness he appeared, a looming shape with a protruding belly. Sigourney rammed the blade into that belly, ripping it up towards the heart. He grunted and fell back to the stairs.
"Oh God, oh God!"
he screamed. Sigourney pulled the blade clear and stepped in close.
"You want to ride double with me, Outlander? You want to enjoy Sigourney?"
"Oh, please, don't kill me."
"You left teeth marks in my breast, you fat bastard. Now bite on this!"
The knife slid between his teeth, and Sigourney slammed it home to the hilt. His fat arms began to flail, but she knelt on his chest and cut his throat. Only when he was still did she mutilate him in the same way she had the first guard. Slowly, she climbed the stairs, pushing open the door at the top. The courtyard was moonlit and deserted, save for a sentry sitting under the arch. He was facing out into the town. Sigourney stepped into the open air and walked across to the arch. The sentry was not even aware of dying. Blood-drenched and weak, Sigourney moved on into the silent town. Abby was dead, killed trying to save her. "And I am dead," she thought. "They will kill me, for I have not the strength to find them all." Somehow the thought of dying held no fear for her. All that kept her moving on tottering feet was the need for vengeance, a need as old as the Highlands themselves. Clan laws were not subtle. Precedents were rarely cited, and there were no glib-tongued lawyers to represent the factions. Wrongdoers were punished by those they had wronged, or in the case of murder were hunted down by clan warriors selected by the Hunt Lord. Justice was sudden, harsh, and final. But Tsigane had no family, save old Gwael who had raised her after the slaughter. There were no men to seek blood revenge.
Only me, she thought. Only Tsigane.
The knife slipped from her fingers and clattered to the street. Stopping, she picked it up, then fell heavily.
Damn,
she whispered. Twisting round, she sat for a while with her back against a cool stone wall. The stars were bright, the night cool with the promise of autumn. Some distance away she could hear the sound of revelers, and knew she was close to the Blue Duck Tavern.
What will you do? She wondered. Walk in, covered in blood, and move from table to table until you see them. What kind of a plan is that? And if you wait past the dawn, they will find you anyway, and drag you back to that cell, and who knows what torture. Are you mad, girl? Leave this place. Get back into the Highlands where you can gather your strength. Two of them are dead, she told herself. One more, at least, is in the tavern. One more.
Forcing herself to her feet, Tsigane groaned. Blood was trickling down her leg. She licked her lips with a dry tongue and tried to blank out the pain.
Women are made for sport.
The words flashed back into her memory. The short soldier had said them at some point during her ordeal. Laughter had followed his words. Then more pain. Suddenly she remembered the little census taker and his revulsion and fear as Abby pecked at him. What was it he had said?
I prefer the hares.
Hares are made for sport, Tsigane had told him.
Everything is made for sport, she realized, in a world ruled by outlanders.
The rest had given her fresh strength, and she walked on. The Blue Duck Tavern was an old building with frayed timbers and white walls. There were four windows on the ground floor, two either side of the old oak door. One of the windows was open, and through it she could hear the sounds of the drinkers. Moving to the wall beside it, she glanced in. The place was packed, and her keen eyes scanned the faces within. There were none she recognized, but then she could see only a section of the crowd. Dropping to her knees, she crawled under the window, then rose and glanced in from the new angle. Two men were walking towards the door. Her heart and her anger lifted. Transferring the knife to her left hand, she wiped the sweat from her right, rubbing the palm down her leggings. The door opened.
That's it, Will. One foot in front of the other. That's the way to go, son.
Shut the bloody door,
said someone inside. Ralph pulled shut the door as Will Stamper leaned against the wall.
Be right with you, mate. But I've got a piece,
said Ralph, opening the front of his leggings and urinating against the wall. Tsigane moved silently alongside the drunken Will and sliced the knife back across his throat. The skin flapped open, blood bubbling clear. Then she ran forward and plunged the blade into Ralph's back. He reared up and, grabbing his hair, she rammed his head against the wall. Falling to his knees, Ralph struggled to turn. Wrenching the knife clear, Tsigane, still holding his hair, dragged his head back to expose his throat.
Women are made for sport, said Tsigane, slashing open his jugular.
Ralph fell back, his arms and legs thrashing. Tsigane stepped clear and moved to where Will stood leaning against the wall, his blood gushing over the front of his tunic. Slowly, he toppled to his knees and looked up at her. There was no hatred in his gaze, and no fear. He tried to speak, but could only mouth two words. Sigourney almost laughed. Then she leaned back and kicked him in the head, and his body fell to the stones. Only one more now, she thought. The captain. But where would he be?
Are you insane, woman?
Came a voice inside her mind.
Leave now.
No, she said aloud. I'll find him.
Leave, and he'll find you. I promise you. Stay, and you will die, and he will love. I promise you that, too.
Who are you? Where are you?
She asked, spinning round and scanning the shadows.
I am with you, girl, and I want your trust. Leave now. Believe me, you won't like being dead. I know. I've tried it. Now go.
Confused, Sigourney obeyed, cutting down through an alley towards the north gate.
The bastards have unhinged my mind, she thought. Now I'm hearing ghost voices.
From the citadel keep came the sound of clanging alarm bells.
I'll never get out now, she thought.
Yes, you will,
said the voice.
Your people need you.
Baron Ranulf Gotterson groaned. The pain had moved beyond pleasure to a burning point of agony that bordered on the exquisite. Narcotics flowed in his blood and his waking dreams were vivid. He saw again the fall of the Kushite cities, refugees running, panic-stricken from their burning homes, heard again the wailing of the soon-to-die, the piercing screams of city-dwellers staring into the brutal faces of the conquering soldiers, feeling the cold bite of their blades into soft, yielding flesh. Days of blood and glory, marching his men across inhospitable deserts, iron mountains and lush foreign plains. And then it was over. No one left to conquer. At first, it had not seemed so onerous. The triumphant return to the capital, the cheering crowds choking the streets, the nights of celebration at the palace, the orgies. The Baron groaned again. He felt someone lift his head, and a cold metal goblet was placed against his lips. He swallowed and sank back. Then had come the day when the organization of the empire was reshaped. Plessius was made governor-general of Kushir and the East, a bumbling fool of a man with not an ounce of ambition in his fat head. A hardly surprising choice to rule a land 3,000 leagues from the capital. The king had chosen wisely. There would be no rebellion from that quarter. Ranulf had let it be known he desired the north. There was nothing here of any worth save cattle and timber. The climate was harsh in winter, perversely changeable in what passed for summer. A little coal was being mined, but there were no deposits of gold or silver, nor even iron. The people were poor and defeated. Ranulf had waited for his appointment, sure in the knowledge that he would be offered anything but the north. The king possessed a mind of astonishing cunning, and he would never offer any general the true object of his desires. Ranulf's mind swam on a sea of delicious pain. He had a spy in Yastai's household, and knew well that the earl desired the west. 17 rich cities, scores of mines, 7 ports, and a thriving commercial network. Together they created the perfect foundation for an assault on the king. Wealth to buy mercenaries, ships to ferry armies and keep them supplied. Oh, how Ranulf had laughed when Yastai had been made High Sheriff of the capital. Despite being a position of great influence, bringing immense wealth, it meant that Yastai was always at court and close to the king. But Yastai's handsome face had worn a smile the following day, when Ranulf had been summoned to the palace. The memory brought a fresh spasm of agony. Ranulf had walked down the long aisle in the chapel of the Blessed Blade to where the king waited with his courtiers around him, Yastai at his right hand. Ranulf knelt before his sovereign, then gazed up into the dark reptilian eyes.
It is reported to me that you desire to govern the north, my good and dear friend, said the king. Your services to the kingdom merit great rewards, and I can think of no greater reward than to bestow upon you that which you most desire. Rise, Baron Ranulph Gotterson, Earl of the North, Governor-General of the Highlands.
To his amazement, Ranulph had managed a smile.
It did not match the grin on Yastai's face. The West had gone to the king's new favourite, Estelm. The feast which followed had been bitter hard for the new baron. The king seated him next to Yastai, and that alone made the food taste of bile and ash.
"My congratulations, Ranulph," said the earl. "I know we do not see eye to eye on many issues, but I would like you to know that I argued most strongly for you to be given the North. I thought it would perhaps ease the animosity between us."
Ranulph looked into the man's dark eyes and saw the humour glinting there.
"Animosity, cousin? Surely not. Friendly rivalry would be more apt, I believe."
"Perhaps," agreed Yastai.
"However, that should now be behind us. You have your own kingdom, as it were, while I must remain in the capital making laws, sitting in judgment surrounded by clerics. Ah, how I envy you."
Ranulph smiled and pictured sliding a red-hot dagger into Yastai's belly. Returning to his townhouse, he'd walked into his library and stood gazing at the map stretched out on the far wall. The empire filled it, from ocean to ocean. Ranulph's mouth was dry, his hands trembling with suppressed tension. The skin of his back and buttocks was still tender, but he knew that he needed the release of the whip. Summoning a servant, he ordered him to fetch Corris. The man's face paled.
"I am sorry, my lord, but Corris packed his belongings and left this morning."
"Left? What do you mean, left?"
The servant swallowed hard.
"He has taken up a new appointment, lord."
The shock hit him like ice upon hot skin. Corris, whom he had trusted above all men and loved better than any woman, and he knew without a shred of doubt where the boy's appointment had taken him.
Yastai!
Dismissing the servant, the baron moved to the window, opening it wide and breathing in the cold night air.
"I don't want to go north, Ranulph. It's cold there, and there are no amusements."
"We will not be going north, sweet boy. But isn't that what you want?"
"Be patient, and all will be revealed." "You don't trust me."
"Of course I trust you. Now don't sulk. I hate that."
And he had explained his plans, talked of his dreams, secure in the knowledge that he was with the one person in all the empire who loved him. Two nights later, bound, gagged and hooded, Corris had been carried down to the secret room below the townhouse. Ranulph had had his arms tied to posts, his legs chained to the wall. Dismissing the soldiers who had brought him, he pulled the hood clear of the boy's beautiful face.
"Oh, Ranulph, please God, don't hurt me."
The baron drew his dagger and pushed the blade into a brazier of hot coals.
"While the blade heats," he said softly, "we will talk of love and trust."
Semi-conscious now, the baron felt the terrible stabs of fire in his eye socket, lancing their way through the opiates in his blood. Corris had been allowed no opiates throughout that long night. Colorin the Finder was comfortably asleep between the two whores when he heard the frenzied hammering at the tavern door below his room. He yawned and stretched, his right arm touching the fleshy shoulder of the plump young woman on his right. She moaned softly and turned over. The slender girl to his left awoke.
"What is happening?" she asked sleepily.
Colorin sat up. The room was cold, the fire long dead.
"I don't know, but someone is anxious to get in,"
he said. He heard the innkeeper tramping down the stairs, cursing as he moved.
All right, I'm coming, damn you."
The sound of bolts being drawn back drifted up to the room, and Colorin heard his name mentioned. Now it was his turn to curse. Clambering over the slender hoar, he grabbed his leggings and began to climb into them. Just then,